My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And it's a pleasure to convene this panel. I say it's a pleasure, but it's not really. I mean, the fact is that this is a bunch of problems that no one would have wished on us. I think it's really quite extraordinary to think back 10 or a few more years and think that the biggest problem the United States confronted was the war in Bosnia. I mean, in retrospect, those were relatively happy days, frankly. And now we face a series of very difficult, intractable problems that we have very little time to discuss, but I know that the panelists will do their best to do it quickly and, I hope, provocatively as well. There's another sign of our times, which is that of the problems we've listed here, I think there's only one that could claim to be getting slightly better rather than worse, and that's Lebanon. And you know that when Lebanon is your source of optimism, you're really in trouble. With those discouraging words, pardon me, I will try to pose for each of the panelists a couple of questions. I will limit them absolutely, indubitably, to 5 minutes each, and I'll stand here scowling so that they don't go over. And then we'll open the floor to broader discussion. And we'll start with Dorina Biko, who is going to talk about prospects for peace and the threat of violence in Sudan. And, you know, USIP has programs in Sudan, and we have programs all over the country. And this week we were notified that we couldn't travel more than 25 miles from Khartoum. So, you know, the question is, why are things getting worse? Not only, I think, in Darfur, but between the U.S. And Khartoum. And what are the regional issues? Because I think we all know that at this point, Sudan is a regional challenge as well as a challenge in and of itself. Dorina, give us your 5 minutes.
Thank you very much.
That doesn't come out of your 5 minutes.
Is this better? Why are things getting worse?
They want you up.
They want me up.
Cameras.
Why are things getting worse between the U.S. and Sudan lately? I think the quick answer to that is Darfur and what the international community would like to see happen in Darfur, which is bringing in UN troops and Sudan's resistance to that for a number of reasons. This week, the Senate finally passed the Darfur Peace and Accountability Act, which was notable for a number of things, including sanctions on visa and financial sanctions. But many people were are upset because the Accountability Act didn't go sort of far enough in maybe putting more pressure on the government by perhaps forcing or recommending that U.S. companies divest from Sudan, which is sort of a key, one of the key things that people think might pressure the government, such much as the South African government was pressured into ending apartheid largely through the Sullivan principles. So that's so I think we're seeing that that argument being played out in making it much more difficult for people to operate in Sudan. Secondly, the regional implications. Right now, Sudan is surrounded by Chad and the Central African Republic, both of which are experiencing internal instability. And right now, the problem is largely, or threatens to largely be a humanitarian issue, with refugees from eastern Chad fleeing to western Sudan, which is Darfur, and compounding the humanitarian issue there. There are also ethnic linkages between the two countries. The Zaghawa are both in eastern Chad and Sudan, and this doesn't seem to be as much of a problem as it was, say, a few months ago or earlier in the year when the Sudanese government was aiding the Chadian rebels and vice versa. But it's not to say that as instability grows in Chad that it will, that type of mutual assistance won't resurface again. And similarly, in the Central African Republic, with the rebels in the northern part of the country, which is largely unprotected and quite porous. In fact, it's not even clear which rebels are fighting in the north, who they are, what their demands are, but there is a sort of huge humanitarian a crisis forming in the region that's unfortunately spilling over into the border of Sudan, which is at the southern part of the Darfur area. So these are the regional issues that, if not properly addressed or anticipated, can exacerbate both the problems in Darfur, the humanitarian crisis, as well as the internal instabilities in Chad and Central African Republic. So.
You have one more minute. What are we going to do about it?
Well, one other issue, actually. okay, I'll answer your question. What are we going to do about it? The regional issue is tricky because there is no strong country in that region. If it was a more perfect world, the DRC would be that country, but the DRC is just not able to, you know, take leadership in that region, and the region itself kind of falls between sort of Horn of Africa and Central Africa. So it's not very clear, you know, who in that region should take leadership, and maybe this is something that either the AU should take up, but it's of course overstretched. So no easy answers to what we should do about it.
Okay. I told you it was going to be a depressing afternoon. There's no question about that. Dan? What are my questions for you? The staff has loyally prepared. They weren't just relying on me to think up these questions. Okay, Iran, what are we facing here? Are these regional ambitions, global ambitions? Is this the extension of domestic politics into the international sphere? And how has the conservative control of the whole apparatus, how does that affect the current situation and how we should react to it?
Well, if you think we don't have some inkling of the questions, you should see the movie The Quiz Show to get a sense of whether we have some inkling as to what's coming down the road. I thought that had to sink in for just a minute. Daniel asked me a lot of tough questions to answer in 5 minutes. In some respects, I think it's fair to say that Iran's foreign policy is an expression and to some extent an outgrowth of its complex internal politics and the way in which various institutions with various interests compete and negotiate in part through the office of the Supreme Leader, the Rahbar, to advance their different agendas. And the consequence is it's very difficult to move Iran in a direction that would be what we, from our perspective, more rational and more sane, a negotiated outcome that would provide Iran some access to a nuclear fuel cycle managed by the international community would go somewhat to addressing its so-called energy needs, but there are, of course, many in Iran who have different interpretations of how to, of the purpose of that kind of energy cycle. So if you look at the pre-Ahmadinejad period, I think you'll see very clearly that you had a situation in which Iran's government was divided between the reformists, who are themselves highly divided groups. There were like 18 different reform factions, of course, and the clerical right, and Rafsanjani's own pragmatic conservatives. And during this period, every effort of the reformists to use global politics and to use foreign relations as a lever to advance their own domestic agenda was responded to by the conservatives with greater blows, because the conservatives understood very well that the reformists saw in their effort to open up to the United States, to establish a dialogue and so on, to find ways, particularly after 9/11, to pursue some sort of cooperation on, say, Afghanistan, that in advancing that foreign policy agenda, they were trying to strengthen their hand at home, and therefore this effort to link domestic to foreign politics from the reformists magnified the perception of risk of the reformist movement, and really was one of the main motivating factors, not the only one, but certainly a crucial factor that convinced, I think, the Supreme Leader and his allies in the clerical right to shut down the reformist movement. And so this phenomenon of divided government, which ended in terms of foreign policy initiatives, for example, if you recall the Afghanistan, the Afghanistan war, the toppling of the Taliban, the efforts that the Iranians put in, which were quite substantial to initially, in effect, support the United States against the Taliban, this effort was defeated and undermined by Iran's own hardliners, who never agreed with it in the first place. That sort of divided government scenario was, the prediction was going to change with the consolidation of power by the conservatives and the emergence of a conservative bloc that would have the power and authority to actually negotiate with the United States. That was the theory. Because after all, with the conservatives in power, it's like Nixon going to China, they could make the case for a deal. And this was the kind of expectation that many, many Iran watchers had. But of course, Iran is one of these countries that's always defying our expectations. And what happened, of course, is that we were reminded after the so-called consolidation of conservative power, first the election of a new Majlis, which was largely taken over by conservative forces, and then, of course, the election of Ahmadinejad, which meant that both the office of the Supreme Leader and the office of President were now occupied by conservatives. It was expected that perhaps the conservatives would find some way to pursue a relationship with the United States beneficial to their interests, on perhaps to some extent on their terms. But as it turns out, of course, the conservatives are in many ways as much, if not more, divided than the divisions that occurred within the reformists and between the reformists and the conservatives. One crucial factor that I think that is making negotiations with Iran very difficult is that Ahmadinejad and the generation of people he represents from the Revolutionary Guard, leaders in the military conflict with Iraq, fundamentally see themselves as resuscitating a kind of Khomeinist ideology, which as a matter of existential principle is opposed to relations with the United States, hostile to Western, particularly American culture, and is bound and determined to use things such as the implicit quest for nuclear weapons as a way of buttressing Iran's power. And therefore, it's very hard to negotiate with this kind of almost xenophobic kind of perspective represented by Ahmadinejad. But the president is only one, and certainly in some respects, from a legal or constitutional point, not a very key player. And I think you have two other players to consider. Of course, you have the position of the Supreme Leader, and he's a man who basically has to negotiate, who's constantly negotiating with people to his right. And people like Yazdi, Ayatollah Yazdi, who represent a more sort of existential, conservative, philosophical position opposed to the United States. And as a consequence of that, the weight of power within the Iranian government is very much antithetical to reaching any kind of consensus on adopting anything other than a pursuit of a defiant position on the West. I will say this in conclusion, since I'm sure I'm running out of time. I have no doubt that Rafsanjani and the business community that he represents are represented well in the Majlis, and you can see if you look at economic policy of the present government, it's a highly divided economic populist policy. There are many within this conservative establishment whose interests would be severely undermined by the imposition of further sanctions, particularly a multilateral sanction agreement supported by the international community and the UN. And therefore, that's one thing that the Iranians want to avoid, even if Ahmadinejad, from his own ideological perspective, would invite sanctions. That's not a position that's supported by many conservatives. The practical problem here is the inability of our Western powers and our allies to come to an agreement on the issue of sanctions. And if we could, and we impose sanctions, I think that over time, we'd see Ahmadinejad first reinforced, but then isolated, and perhaps the basis for some sort of negotiated outcome. But in many respects, the problem exists more in terms of Western disunity than Iranian disunity.
Thank you, Dan. I owe a particular debt of gratitude to Patricia Karam because I was originally scheduled to answer the question she has today. What can be done to save Iraq? Well, the first question is, what do we mean by saving Iraq? And in particular, is the rise of this sectarian politics, is it inevitable? Is it unstoppable? Patricia?
Since I was misled into thinking that I had 10 minutes instead of 5, I'm going to quickly mention mention a list of things and then go straight at the question about the inevitability of sectarian politics or the evitability. So what do we mean when we say that Iraq needs saving? I think aside from a raging insurgency and a reconstruction that's stalled by the security situation, we need to take into account a number of indicators when trying to save Iraq, if you will. And those, I will run through them, and I'm happy to talk about them more during discussion. Those include things like internally displaced persons, including the ghettoization that's taking place, the legacy of group grievance, including the feelings of resentment among Iraq's communities, which have transformed themselves into vengeance calls. Sectarian killings, as we all know, are at an all-time high. The brain drain, the sharp economic decline. I will only mention the unemployment figure, which is conservatively cited at 30%, but others have cited figures as high as 50 or 60%. And this has disproportionately affected youth, given that 65% of the population is under 25. There's also progressive deterioration of public services, corruption and delegitimization of the state, and a security apparatus that operates as a state within a state. Every party or organization, as we know and as we read about every day, has its own militia. Every Iraqi is permitted to keep a Kalashnikov at home. The militia seem to be eclipsing the government, which is run by leaders beholden to many of the groups. So with that very sketchy outline, is the rise of sectarian politics inevitable? Today what we have is a weak state, but we have the rise of alternative sources of power where, for example, mosques, which were previously untainted political institutions, have turned into party headquarters and become sites of political mobilization, with clerics outfitting themselves as politicians and drawing on a Shiite history of oppression for support. The Sunnis have followed suit. the January elections, as we all know, have sealed the elimination of the secular center and its replacement by identity politics. Sectarianism has become incredibly pronounced with the formal distribution of power in government institutions, which have become party fiefdoms. Interior Ministry is commandeered by Skiri, health and transportation for the Sadrists. Most ministries require applicants to present an attestation of good conduct from the party whose official is the minister. So what you have, in fact, is a situation of is a pseudo-Libanization, if you will, which is itself a term that gained currency among political scientists after the Lebanese Civil War and came to mean practically, basically, the substitution of the state by militias organized around communal identity who became real power brokers. Some have argued today that political concessions need to be made to the Sunnis, and some of these have been taken up by the government. They also argue that it's important to reassure Sunnis that their provinces will get a share of the oil revenue, that a Shia super region in the south will not emerge and break up Iraq. However, steps to reach out to the Sunni community are, in my opinion, unlikely to succeed, not just from a practical or administrative side, but also because of the socio-political landscape, the context of politics tainted by sectarian identity, and a Shia coalition in power that's highly influenced by Iran, not very responsive to accommodating the Sunnis. On the other hand, there are others who have argued that dividing Iraq into three parts is more viable than trying to strengthen or rebuild a single central state, seeing the separation as the only solution to the violence. However, the three-state solution is not a viable solution, and that is not just practically. Forget about inviting Iran's exploitation of rivalries between the Sistanites and the Sadrists, or Turkey's fear of politicizing the Kurds in Turkey, or risking opening up rivalries between the Kurdish factions in the north. More basically, this option and vision is based on a simplistic version of what Iraq and Iraqis are. This is the main point that I would like to make. Reducing Iraq into three monolithic homogeneous communities, that is, opposing groups driven by unified communal interests which can split neatly into three regions or areas, is misleading. Proponents of the three-state solution have also relied on arguments about Iraq's frailty as a nation-state, the artificiality of its borders, seeing Iraq as haphazardly cobbled together from the wreckages of the Roman Empire, is the phrase used. Iraq is viewed as an artificial creation that merges three provinces of the Ottoman Empire, in the south, the predominantly Arab Shia Basra, in the center, predominantly Arab Sunni Baghdad, and in the north, the mostly Kurdish-inhabited Mosul. And they argue that these three are kept united and stable through the strong hand of an authoritarian ruler, and therefore easily deconstructed into their original components. Iraq is said to have failed to generate a national identity greater than the sum of its societal parts. The alternative readings to this sees the formation of Iraqi identity during the past 80 years as a byproduct of both a sequence of powerful central governments and the development of an Iraqi common culture that's driven by a dynamic middle class until its attrition and demise in the 80s. Iraq, the nation, would have accordingly acquired a social reality, granted with some inbuilt potential for schism, although not as neatly as three ethnic religious fault lines, replete with renditions of cross-sectarian alliances forged over time among Iraqi communities. That is to say that the outbreak of sectarianism today does not flow directly from the sectarian politics of the previous regime, but follows from its nature, a violently repressive authoritarian regime which eradicated old forces and political representatives, for example, the communists, which tended to be cross-communal, and generated new forces like the religious ones as part of extending control. I see that I'm supposed to speed it up. So I would like to say that basically before I end, I would like to say one thing, that while the potential for ethnic and sectarian tensions may have existed, the emergence of sectarianism after the removal of the Ba'ath regime required the ability of political actors with expressed sectarian agendas to operate in a permissive environment. With the Governing Council, for example, sect and ethnicity became for the first time in history the formal organizing principle in politics. So, is the rise of sectarianism inevitable? Prior to the Ba'ath rise to power, civil society was vibrant, based on not on communal identity only, but on economic interests, political networks, competing ideologies, professional unions, associations, writers, artists, free press, coffee house cultures, centered around discussions of political and cultural issues of the day. Such overlapping ties brought together members of different ethnic and sectarian communities. There's plenty of evidence on top of it pointing to the complexity of Iraqi identity politics and the underlying strength of a genuine Iraqi identity and nationalism, which has nothing to do with ethnic or religious exclusivity and everything to do with cross-fertilization. Perhaps it is time to, for whoever, the government of Iraq, perhaps to be genuinely involved in restoring this memory to counter the distrust among groups, to remind Iraqis what they have in common as opposed to what they have, what divides them. Perhaps it is also time to take into account a reality that is less talked about. It is the reality that I deal in my work with every day, the reality of a large number of Iraqis who are involved across ethnic and communal lines in civil life, and they are committed to change at the grassroots level. The reality of a vibrant press, of the activism of women's groups, of the spread, of the reemergence and spread of artists and literary unions, all of which are cross-communal and inter-ethnic. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patricia. Patricia took my notes away, so that will end the pre-prepared questions. thank you, Patricia. You've been cheered so far by lack of a solution in Sudan, gloomy prospects in Iran, a little bit of cheer from civil society in Iraq. And now we can let you down again with Afghanistan. Beth, why are things not going right in Afghanistan, and what can we do about it?
I want to start with a simple proposition about any society emerging from conflict. When we go into that place and try to help the local people rebuild their nation, and that is that you have a small, short window of opportunity. Some say 3 months, 6 months, some say 18 months. Whatever it is, it's a short amount of time. And through that window, you have to apply and throw through that window a number of different resources in the form of people, money, and strategies. You have to build the capacity of the state to deliver essential services to the people first and foremost. You have to deliver those essential services, and first and foremost among those is security. And the third thing is you have to diminish the threats to that reconstruction and rebuilding of the state from those who either prosecuted the war or want that chaos of war to continue. Let's look at Afghanistan. We checked a number of very important boxes. We had some incredible successes. Among them, the Afghanistan people wanted, and still do, want to build a nation, unlike some of these other places that really want to disintegrate. Afghans want a state. We have a president. We created a constitution. I shouldn't say we. The Afghan people and the international community enabled the president to run the country. We created a constitution. We have a sitting parliament. We held two elections. We have some ministers. We did all that in a short period of time. But what we didn't do was we didn't enable that government to extend the provision of essential services throughout the country. So we left a lot of these ungoverned spaces, a lot of places that we didn't fill with governance. We didn't fill with reconstruction. And what happened at the same time, when we let the Taliban and others go across the border into Pakistan, regroup economically, regroup politically, regroup militarily, and they came in and filled those spaces. It's not rocket science. That is why we face the situation that we face today. I just spent lunch with our representative of the Secretary General in Afghanistan. Neither the UN or the government can go into five provinces in the south. They are effectively ruled by the Taliban. There is no governance there. What can we do to change the situation? First, governance. President Karzai has to take a firm hand. He has to appoint credible people. The international community has to then put their money through the government. They have to build capacity. Currently, 6% of aid money is going through the government of Afghanistan. That government will never be legitimate if it can't deliver that money to its own people. They don't want to give the money to Afghanistan because they view it as corrupt, the government. So Karzai has to get rid of the people that we can't trust, that are known to have done things that could put, in other places, would be behind bars. Not one official has been indicted. He must get control of that situation and appoint good people. The international community, in turn, must put their money through the government. They must deliver essential services. First, they must pay attention to the police force. The police currently make $16 a month after bribes and other money is filtered down from Kabul down to the local level. The Taliban pays twice that to their fighters. That is an intolerable situation. We have to turn that around. We can turn that around. There's 1,500 advisors throughout, I'm sorry, that's not correct. There's 150 advisors in the country trying to reconstruct the police force. It's estimated we need 4,400. Let's get the 4,400 in there. Let's start to build that rule of law capability throughout the country. Governance. There's a program. It's a wonderful program. Everybody should look at this program. It's a model. It's called the National Solidarity Program. It has covered 20,000 cities and localities in Afghanistan. There's 40,000 total. We need to expand it to 20,000 more. What is that program? It is where the international community puts money through local shuras, through local organizations that have representatives of the community, women, religious leaders, tribal leaders, and those people determine the projects that are going to occur in their local community. They go in and they build the schools. They do the projects. They manage the money. They learn what it is to govern their own space. Again, I asked the SRSG today, if you could, just like, you know, you go to Wall Street and you say, okay, what do I invest in? Please tell me what to invest in. He said, the National Solidarity Program. And I said, well, how much money do you need? He said, we need to double the resources for the National Solidarity Program. There is absolutely no question that we know what to do, that we have some wonderful things that we've done there. We just need to redouble our efforts right now, put more resources in. At the same time, we're going to have to figure out a way to negotiate with Pakistan. We're going to have to figure out a way to negotiate with the Taliban. I'm saying negotiation, reconciliation. How do we bring those people in as opposed to letting them stay over the border and regroup and then recruit fighters and come back into the country and wreak havoc? This is difficult, hard work. But I'd be growing sunflowers out in the Shenandoah Valley if I didn't think we could do this. We know how to do this. We've done it in many, many places. And I would say, as the chair of our Afghanistan working group, Barney Rubin, said the other day in the United States Senate, Afghanistan is ours to lose right now. We can turn this around, and we can turn it around quickly if we just commit the resources, commit and execute the strategies that we know work in other places, that we know worked in Afghanistan. So I'm actually quite hopeful. Is that okay?
Wow. Somebody.
Somebody with a little cheer, some solutions. I thank you, Beth. Anybody who has any doubt what an ungoverned space is should watch the Frontline piece that was on last night about Afghanistan. It's quite spectacular. It's the concreteness of what it means to be an ungoverned space. Scott Lesinski is going to, I hope, give us a little bit more hope. I mean, here we've had a war. We have a peace. We have a peacekeeping force. Where does it go from here? How do we build on what apparently is a successful ceasefire? But it's only a ceasefire. The Security Council resolution is very clear about that. It's a cessation of hostilities. There's actually a further council resolution envisaged, and that has never been adopted. I don't know what the plans are for that. And you know, what can we do to build on a relatively positive step, and can it be built on to build a broader base for Middle East peace?
Thank you, Daniel, and thanks to Abdeslam Ograwi for putting this together. I'll keep the hope alive. Beth left me smiling, so. But seriously, I think there's a lot that can be done. The Middle East peace process, the relations between Israel and its Arab neighbors often leave people with this impression of intractability and primordial conflict, and you want to just wash your hands of it. But I take a very different view, and I think the people at the Institute do as well. This is a conflict that can be whittled down. Let me just divide the 5 minutes, 2.5 minutes on diagnosis, 2.5 minutes on a prescription, and I'll depart a little bit from the specifics of Lebanon and try to bring things into a very holistic, a full picture of the whole Arab-Israeli realm. First, the diagnosis. Clearly, it's a period of stagnation, and we're all having a hard time because Arabs and Israelis are in a deep period of stagnation, partly due to conflicts within their own political settings. Lebanon is a perfect example. Those internal conflicts get projected, but also due to problems in past attempts to negotiate. The failures at peacemaking often lead to stagnation, too. You have a very dangerous combination of weak leaders in Israel, the Palestinian government today. It's not just the Hamas-run government, but it's, in many respects, the whole Palestinian national movement is sort of up for grabs and lacking both the goals and a lot of questions about means and ends. Weak governments. You have governments and regional powers in the area trying to muck things up. The Iranian influence is obviously a troubling one. And there's what I would call a lack of pressure from outside parties. The contrast, Daniel mentioned the war this summer between Hezbollah and Israel, between Lebanon and Israel. The contrast, when you look at the fighting and the aftermath with earlier conflicts, a couple of months ago, I finished a study looking at the 1973 war, the Arab-Israeli war, and the kind of diplomacy that followed the aftermath of what seemed to be almost a cataclysmic war. You know, the stakes were much higher then than, not to minimize what happened this summer, but in the aftermath of that very horrific conflict, the U.S. found a formula in which to bring the parties together, and it led to a process, incremental as it was, but it led to realizing opportunities from the depths of what looked like tragic conflict. And I think the present situation calls for a similar effort. Stagnation is dangerous. It tears at the fabric of the Arab-Israeli peace process, what there is. We often forget. You look at Palestinians and Israelis fighting and Hezbollah and Israel fighting. There is a larger fabric of the Arab-Israeli relationship, a peace between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Jordan, not to be taken for granted. These can erode and probably will erode over time if the full circle of Arab-Israeli peace can't be completed. Stagnation is dangerous, too, for the United States. It makes everything we do in the region complicated. There's a lot of issues we work on this conflict at the Institute. There's one we haven't worked on, we could probably do a better job on, finding the specific connections between the Israeli-Palestinian dispute and the larger Arab-Israeli question and other conflicts within the region. All you hear are two arguments. One is, well, it's the root of all things that are going wrong in the Middle East, and others will tell you, well, it's actually rather marginal, and Arab leaders just put it up as a shield to try to block discourse in their own countries. Well, it's really not one or the other. It's probably somewhere in between. And understanding the connection more specifically would help. There are opportunities that do exist, and here I'll get into prescription. There are broad conditions between the parties that we need to take advantage of. You can even look at some of the USIP publications. This year we put out a report on Palestinian public opinion. Yes, Hamas won the election, but if you look at the long-term trends, as Khalil Shikaki pointed out in our report, there's a growing Palestinian consensus for a two-state solution. The same in Israel. Israeli thinking about about Palestinian statehood. We have a report coming out very soon by Shlomo Brom, who was here for the last year as a visitor. And it says that, as no time before, there's a growing consensus, not just in Israel, but particularly in the Israeli national security community, defense and intelligence community, about Palestinian statehood and what needs to be done to make it happen. Let me offer, if I can take an extra minute, if Dan grants me, I'm going to offer four arenas in which I think the United States, as an outside party, could do a better job in trying to broker Arab-Israeli peace. This is somewhere between what I'd call the ripeness theory and the light switch theory. You know, the ripeness theory that somehow we just have to sit around and wait around for things to become ripe, and then only then intervene, only leads you to a conclusion of, you know, sort of sitting on your hands. So I don't think ripeness is the way to go. And also the sort of light switch theory, which could be seen. If you look at today's New York Times, there's an ad by the International Crisis Group. They want to bring a Middle East conference together, and they have a lot of people sign on a statement. It's a laudable statement, but the notion that you can have a meeting and sort of flip a switch and settle the conflict is, I don't think, the right one. There are all four areas where I think we could do a better job and spark a renewed Arab-Israeli peace process. First, on foreign aid, we spend a lot of money, unlike in Iraq, where we have people, and we spend money. On the Arab-Israeli realm, we generally just spend money, time and money. And of all the money that's been invested, I think invested wisely over the years, we've gotten to a point now where our foreign aid to Israel and to its neighbors is largely subsidizing the status quo and not propelling the parties toward additional compromises and peacemaking. I think we have to de-link foreign aid from the current situation, where it's to be expected, it's treated almost as an entitlement. Conditionality has sort of fallen by the wayside, with the Hamas issue being a bit of an exception, but I'll talk about that in a minute. So I think the whole way in which we spend our foreign aid and make promises and follow through on them need to be reconsidered. Second, in terms of monitoring, we do a good job blessing Arab-Israeli agreements, but we don't do a great job monitoring them and following up on them. There's a long history in the Oslo process that points to this, but also just last November when Secretary Rice brokered a somewhat unprecedented agreement to unravel this Gordian knot of access between Gaza and Egypt and Gaza and the West Bank and Gaza and Israel and try to breathe some life into a Gaza Strip without an Israeli presence. You know, there was no follow-up. So a great document on paper lacked a good monitoring. Third, the idea of an international presence. I wouldn't start big. A trusteeship for Palestine has been proposed before, but very targeted international deployments. The case in Lebanon, which is maybe a bit more than targeted, but here, if you think about it, the goals are still kind of modest on monitoring arms shipment and monitoring the border. I think the international presence at Rafah on the Egypt-Gaza border is an important precedent and needs to be replicated on the Gaza-Israel border, the crossings at Karni, not to get too much into the weeds, but we're going to have to think much more about what the international community is step in when there's a lack of trust between the sides, but yet you still have to compromise, particularly on issues of access. You need a presence. And lastly, I see Dan approaching in the back. Fourth, we need to do a much better job on what I call red lines and goalposts. We don't do a good enough job setting red lines, whether it's on issues of violence or settlements, Israeli settlements, but we also have to do a much better job at setting out goalposts. The only thing the international community really says right now, the only official word on an Israeli-Palestinian settlement is the peace plan known as the roadmap, but the roadmap is, as it's been called before, a roadmap without a destination. We haven't told the parties what we see the goalposts are, where they need to get. And I think we need to be much more specific about that through UN Security Council declarations, through declarations of governments, particularly the United States. It would do a lot to mobilize the moderates. And lastly, because I see one of our new colleagues, I should mention, these are all policy ideas for governments to implement. There's a hell of a lot to do outside of official channels in the non-governmental realm. And here we have a new fellow in the room, Hassan Barari from Jordan, who's going to look at how Arabs study Israel and the whole issue of education. And there's a lot that needs to be done and a lot more to explore sort of outside of official channels. So let me leave it for you there.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Well, I'm going to open the floor. I've had my chance to ask questions. I hope we have microphones on both sides. I hope our participants will take advantage of the microphones. I see some moving in that direction. You know, the usual thing to say is just ask a question, don't say anything more. I won't do that. I see in the room a lot of very knowledgeable people, and though I may try to limit you a bit, I won't cut you off. I think we'd like to hear from some folks. And Abukir Mukhtar, introduce yourself, please, and take it from there.
My name is Abukir Mukhtar. I'm from Sudan. I'm a senior fellow with the U.S. Institute of Peace, one of the new fellows. My term is about to finish. I just want to thank the panelists for their insightful presentations. It's really, I'm interested in them all. I'm quite sure that I don't have the time to ask questions or comment on them, but I just want to restrict myself to Sudan. 2 days ago, I was invited by Al Hurra TV for an interview on Darfur. And the question was, why the government of Sudan refused to allow the UN peacekeeping force? What are the real reasons? And what is going to be done? What is the international community going to do about it? And in the background for the interview, they showed this report, including an interview with John Dye Fraser, and the presenter asked her this question. He said, what are your government going to do in relation to Khartoum's rejection and refusal of allowing UN peacekeeping force? And she said, we have to persuade Khartoum, we do this and do that. And then he said to her, but Khartoum refused, and what are you going to do about it? And she's still repeating the same, we have to persuade. And he asked her the question like 4 or 5 times, and there was no answer. And I think these two basic questions, why Khartoum is refusing the UN to allow UN peacekeeping force, and what is the international community and the American administration going to do? These are the two basic questions, which if we got right answer to, then I think we will understand whether Khartoum could retreat or change its mind or not, first. And second, why the government is insisting on this position. I think the rejection, I just want to suggest quickly two answers to these questions. The first is that Khartoum refusal have nothing to do with anything that they forwarded as reasons, because anything that they said is not founded on any good reasons and is contradicting the situation in Khartoum. They said first it will be an invasion and occupation, but we already have UN peacekeeping force in Sudan. And so the real reasons, which are not said, is that the refusal is coming from the president and is using this position to enforce his authority vis-a-vis his vice president, Ali Osman Muhammad Taha. And because Ali Osman Muhammad Taha said he would allow UN peacekeeping force, and when Bashir said to him, no, that is not going to happen, that's not a good idea at that time, He then commented in a way that provoked Bashir to, he said to him, this is just like he's a military guy who doesn't know the situation very well. So he said, then he confronted his vice president and he said to him, from now on, only what the military say, this is going to go. So, and this is the situation, it is a totally internal situation. And because the international community and also the U.S. Administration doesn't know what to do as consequences of Khartoum rejection, this is going to play in favor of Khartoum, and because they knew that there is no serious consequences that would take place as a result of their refusal. So I think we have to think about what is to be done as by way of consequences vis-à-vis Khartoum's refusal. Thank you.
Thank you, Abubakar. Please.
Well, Hossein Abnius of International Petroleum Enterprises.
Could you come closer to the mic?
Sure. The common denominator in the answers I heard was the failed U.S. policies, basically. On the Sudan, there was no mention of the South, the problems that they've had, and they will continue to have, the Chinese heavy involvement in their economy and so on. So you had one more minute to talk about, at least mention those. Dan talked about Iran, he talked about Rafsanjani. He labeled him as a pragmatic conservative. Well, maybe that's what he is now, but he actually should have been credited for the movement in Iran, for the middle, you know, group, the reformers. He started all that.
Yeah, he put Khatami.
Well, no one really took him seriously, and then no one took Khatami seriously. And now that Ahmadinejad is in, now you're advocating sanctions. Well, what did sanctions, bring to Iraq? So it's, that's going to be, really a problem. Patricia talked about the Shias, how they started this problem, using the mosques and so on. Well, Friday prayers are not really normal, for the Shias. They don't, it's not a part of their normal practice. It was the Sunnis that used the mosques and so on. At least that was the impression that I got.
Yeah, no, that was just an example to talk about the religiosization, if you will, of politics, as opposed to, or the movement in centers of power.
Right. And also sharing of the oil money and so on. No one talks about that when it comes to the same situation in Kuwait or Saudi Arabia, where majority of the oil is produced in the Shia region, and yet there is a great push to do to do that there. So these are basically some of the issues that I thought of.
Well, thank you. I'm going to take that as a comment on U.S. policy rather than something that. We have to respond to. Stanley?
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute, primarily for Professor Brumberg. Sanctions have been mentioned. What if the United States or Israel actually attack Iran, deadline spring 2008?
What is the latter part of your sentence?
With a deadline of the spring of 2008.
What happens if?
If the attack occurs by the spring of 2008. The sanctions would require more time, and what I'm reading is tighter deadline.
Dan, you want to?
On the question of the comment on American foreign policy, I, speaking personally here, I don't think that it could be said with any great confidence that our approach to Iran has met with a great success, if I may be diplomatic about it. I think this is a fair statement. And part of the reality is that if Tehran has been sort of divided, so has Washington. And there's been years of quasi-paralysis in the policy community about what to do with Iran, and we focus on Iraq, and look where we are now. So I think that, we haven't, that isn't a great record. The axis of evil approach It made it very hard for the reformers to project their power and put them in a very unenviable position. And we are now caught in a difficult situation because there's no observer of Iran's approach to the whole question of proliferation who doesn't agree, no sensible observer, including those sort of on the left, that Iran is in constant violation. So the question is, what is to be done? And I think that given the nature of the current regime, although it's a high-stakes gamble, I think a multilateral sanctions, the threat of a multilateral sanctions scenario might get their attention, but of course I could be wrong. Having said that, I don't think, again, here I rely on the experts. If you read other experts, let me know. But I haven't seen many experts who would agree that a military attack on Iran would have the desired effects and would really produce the kinds of results we're looking for. Quite the contrary. Unfortunately, when it comes to dealing with Iran, particularly given Iran's considerable leverage, paradoxically, as a consequence of events in Iraq, our own leverage and our own options are highly limited. We're stuck in the Woody Allen sort of spectrum between the horrible and the terrible. You know, there's not a lot of options here. So I think we have to recognize this. Had we been operating a few years ago under different circumstances, it would be different. But the options have narrowed, in part as a consequence, I must say personally, once again, of our, as far as I'm concerned, of our own policies.
Colonel Datta, Foreign Policy Association, President of Indian Veteran Association of North America. I have spent 17 years in the Middle East, and I find many of the observations made here do not touch the ground realities. Patricia has said that the description of erstwhile society which existed, which had risen above the sectarian lines, it was more promising to all sections of society, was secular. And is she implying that Saddam Hussein's regime was much better, which was secular and in many respects than the sectarian riddled Iraq, which is on the verge of breakup through the civil war? And talking about Iran, you, I think, has missed out the very important factor. Talibans, which were aided and abetted through Hikmatyar, and he is still influencing, and there has been a resurgence of Taliban in Afghanistan. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia.
Just to clarify, I was referring to the pre-Saddam era.
Dan.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't completely reject what you're saying, but I would say that the fundamental motivating force behind the resurgence of the Taliban is not Hikmatyar or Iran. I don't agree with that.
Speak up a little, Dan.
I simply don't agree with the assumption underlining your remarks. But we can agree to disagree. After all, we're all about conflict resolution.
Please.
My name is Brian Marshall. I've just recently returned from service with the Iraq Reconstruction Management Office in Baghdad. And obviously my question is directed primarily to Ms. Karim. Now, Ambassador Khalilzad has indicated some time back that he feels that the government of Iraq has some 6 months to get control of the situation there. Now, this is obviously a very extremely difficult situation. Now, key to that situation is the Ministries of Defense and Interior. Minister Jaber previously, in the previous government, is alleged to have done a terrible job at Interior. There are tremendous amounts of corruption. There have been a lot of corruption also at Defense. There are a lot of problems with militias and poor performance on the part of the police, not to mention some reports of Iranian linkages on the part of Minister Jaber. But in light of the situation, how do you feel about these two, the new ministers in the Minister Prime Minister Maliki's government, how do you feel about their prospects for their capacities and their capabilities and their willingness to get control of the situation in their respective ministries?
Patricia?
My work primarily has focused on civil society, so I can talk a little bit more about that. I think the situation of the militias is somehow tied to the political parties who are in power, because most of those are linked to politicians, aside from splinter groups which have emerged as well. But maybe, Dan, do you want to tackle the issue of the two ministers?
Well, no, I don't want to. I think the jury's still out. I mean, I think the jury's still out on, on this government in Iraq. And there's not much you can say about it other than that. I think, Brian, you characterized the previous situation. I mean, it is what it was, and you have to start from where you are.
One thought from some former colleagues, I have heard some good things about the new Minister of the Interior. He is willing to go into the red zone, which Mr. Jaffe was not.
Thank you. My name is Fauzia Tomadi, and I'm from Afghanistan. I'm an employee of federal government here. Actually, my comments first to Beth. Thank you so much for giving us that positive hope and encouragement. I know that Afghanistan is going to a good direction now. My comments are, first, is the problem of Afghanistan right now is the interference of the neighboring countries. As we all know, that in Afghanistan reached the point that the whole country, the civilian and the population of Afghanistan would like to rebuild and reconstruct their land. But the insurgency, which would be encouraged by neighboring country, would interfere and cause a lot of problem down there. And also, your plan is great plan, but I hope it would be implemented immediately because the situation is changing dramatically in that region. Also, with the help of politicians and American, peace-loving American here, trying to do something good in Afghanistan or other regions in order to bring peace and stability, I would like to convey my message, if you think it's better, that getting involved with the rebuilding of Afghanistan and with the warlords, drug lords, all these tribal leaders, do you think it would be possible that we could bring these warlords here, just invite them to break the wall and the barrier between peace lords and warlords, and they could sit here and talk to the policymakers and feel and breathe the freedom, peace, opportunities that this country offers, and the exact democratic values that we have here, that they could come for a few days and be there, as well as the leaders of tribal leaders, Pashtuns. Once they're here and they see the hospitality, we, the community of Afghan, would be willing to help with that program if the United States policymakers would like to do that.
Beth, you've got a specific proposition.
Well, I think USIP has a grand tradition of reaching out across all of the sectors of population and trying to bring people together and foster dialogue. We do have some ideas about going in and trying to build some bridges between people on both sides of the border, Afghanistan and Pakistan, and also within Afghanistan. Bringing them here, I don't know. We haven't really thought about that yet.
The truth is that, except with some small exceptions, USIP doesn't usually bring people here. We work much more on the ground there. The people who bring people here are the U.S. Embassy, and they would have to be convinced, both because of visa requirements and because of the international visitor program requirements, that this would be a, that there would be a positive outcome. But the idea has been floated, and that's good. So thank you for putting it forward.
Hi, my name is Yvette Sherney, and I'm from the University of California. And I had a question to Dorina. We led a divestment movement on our campus, and as the largest public school in the world, it was a huge accomplishment on our part. I'm from the Irvine campus, and I was on the forefront of this movement. And I had a question. A lot of people had been asking me or some criticism in coining what's happening in Darfur as a genocide. And the questions I received a lot were the fact that the UN hasn't and other countries haven't, but the U.S. has. And possibly the reason why the U.S. has called it genocide is to further possible political or economic interests in that region. I was just wondering, how would you respond to this claim?
Dorina?
No, I think the U.S. calls it a genocide because there's a mass-scale murder of people of the Darfurians. I don't think it was... I can't see how calling it a genocide would further U.S. economic interests.
Well, I guess it would open an avenue to intervene there. And basically a lot from the... more of the Muslim community is very against intervention, so they're... concern is that is this just another way to, you know, kind of go in there, and there is oil in Sudan, and those claims have, I mean, I don't think they're valid, but
I don't find those believable, so.
I don't believe there's oil in Darfur anyway.
Right.
I haven't heard of any. I'm going to wrap up. One more. We can deal with one more.
My name is Mary Mullen. I just heard Mr. Soros speak yesterday, and whether or not he wants me to quote him, we were talking about the ICC court, and he was saying that he felt the ICC court should or could indict the president of Sudan. Instead of, we were talking about how the ICC court has indicted several people from northern Uganda, but yet has no way.
That's your proposition, Mary, indictment of the president?
Yes, we were discussing, the reason he brought this up is we were discussing how the ICC court has to rely on a country turning over their indictees, that they have no other way of getting the, or even though they indict them, they have no way of incarcerating them or apprehending them. So
Dorina, you want to comment on that?
On whether Bashir should be indicted?
Right. I mean, if there's genocide, and if it's being carried out by the order of the government of Sudan...
It's on the record, then?
This is on the record.
I think, I mean, some of the things that the ICC considers when it goes forward with an indictment are... You know, there are always, and this was the case in Uganda as well, there are costs to an indictment as well as benefits. One of the many costs, particularly in the LRA case, was they were afraid that indicting Kony would prevent any type of negotiations from sort of taking place. And in fact, just looking at what happened since they've indicted Kony, the Ugandan government has actually had to come in and say that it's going to give him amnesty, essentially setting the ICC indictments aside or on the back burner for them to start negotiations with Kony. And I imagine that those are the same considerations that would have to go into, you know, whether or not you would indict Bashir is what are the costs of doing so versus not.
Thank you. I'm going to wrap us up. I'm asked to announce it on October 17th. Do you know the hour, Patricia?
3 to 5.
3 to 5, we'll be discussing what does it mean to be an Iraqi, identity politics in Iraq. And I know Abdeslam wants the floor for just a moment.
Thank you. I'll be very brief. Thank you all for coming. And I would like to thank all of my colleagues who participated in the panels today. It is very interesting to see how different works come together today in this panel. I should note that we will be publishing a Muslim World Reader that puts together all of the Institute's work on the Muslim world that covers all of the themes that we discussed today, as well as some of the pivotal conflicts, and it should be published in 2007. There is obviously a lot of work to be done on the Muslim world, and there are areas that we should be thinking about, such as the Sunni-Shi'i fault lines that may be emerging in the future, the possibility of terrorist networks linking with criminal networks throughout the globe. That's another area of concern. And also to think about the potential of drawing on progressive Islamic traditions and not to dismiss Islam or religion as a way to perhaps advance reforms in the Muslim world. So I thank you all for coming, and our literature is outside there, and please come again, and thank you.